stomach gnawed and growled. All around him, walkers were compulsively celebrating the end of the first 24 hours on the road. Scram grinned at Garrity through a mouthful of cheese spread and said something pleasant but untranslatable. Baker had his vial of olives, real olives, and was popping them into his mouth with machine gun regularity. Pearson was jamming crackers mounded high with tuna spread into his mouth, and McVries was slowly eating chicken spread. His eyes were half-lidded, and he might have been in extreme pain or at the pinnacle of pleasure. Two more of them had gone down between 8:30 and 9. One of them had been the Wayne that the gas jockey had been cheering for a ways back. But they had come 99 miles with just 36 gone. Isn't that wonderful? Garrity thought, feeling the saliva spurt in his mouth as McVries mopped the last of the chicken concentrate out of the tube and then cast the empty aside. Great. I hope they all drop dead right now. A teenager in pegged jeans raced a middle-aged housewife for McVries' empty tube, which had stopped being something useful and had begun its new career as a souvenir. The housewife was closer, but the kid was faster, and he beat her by half a length. Thanks, he hollered to McVries, holding the bent and twisted tube aloft. He scampered back to his friends, still waving it. The housewife eyed him sourly.
Aren't you eating anything? McVries asked.
I'm making myself wait.
For what?
9:30. McVries eyed him thoughtfully.
The old self-discipline bit?
Garrity shrugged, ready for the backlash of sarcasm, but McVries only went on looking at him.
You know something? McVries said finally.
What?
If I had a dollar, just a dollar, mind you, I think I'd put it on you, Garrity. I think you've got a chance to win this thing.
Garrity laughed self-consciously.
Putting the whammy on me?
The what?
The whammy. Like telling a pitcher he's got a no-hitter going.
Maybe I am, McVries said. He put his hands out in front of him. They were shaking very slightly. McVries frowned at them in a distracted sort of concentration. It was a half-lunatic sort of gaze.
I hope Barkovich buys out soon, he said.
Pete?
What?
If you had to do it all over again, if you knew you could get this far and still be walking, would you do it?
McVries put his hands down and stared at Garrity. Are you kidding? You must be.
No, I'm serious.
Ray, I don't think I'd do it again if the Major put his pistol up against my nates. This is the next thing to suicide, except that a regular suicide is quicker.
True, Olson said. How true.
He smiled a hollow concentration camp smile that made Garrity's belly crawl. 10 minutes later, they passed under a huge red and white banner that proclaimed, 100 miles! Congratulations from the Jefferson Plantation Chamber of Commerce! Congratulations to this year's Century Club Long Walkers!
I got a place where they can put their Century Club, Collie Parker said. It's long and brown and the sun never shines there.
Suddenly, the spotty stands of second-growth pine and spruce that had bordered the road in scruffy patches were gone, hidden by the first real crowd they had seen. A tremendous cheer went up, and that was followed by another, and another. It was like surf hammering on the rocks. Flashbulbs popped and dazzled. State police held the deep ranks of people back, and bright orange nylon restraining ropes were strung along the soft shoulders. A policeman struggled with a screaming little boy. The boy had a dirty face and a snotty nose. He was waving a toy glider in one hand and an autograph book in the other.
"Geez," Baker yelled. "Geez, look at him! Just look at them all!"
Collie Parker was waving and smiling, and it was not until Garrity closed up with him a little that he could hear him calling in his flat Midwestern accent,
"Glad to see you, you goddamn bunch of fools."
A grin and a wave.
"How are you, Mother McCree, you goddamn bag? Your face in my ass, what a match. How are you, how are you?"
Garrity clapped his hands over his mouth and giggled hysterically. A man in the first rank, waving a sloppily lettered sign with Scram's name on it, had popped his fly. A row back, a fat woman in a ridiculous yellow sunsuit was being ground between three college students who were drinking beer. Stone ground fatty, Garrity thought, and laughed harder.
"You're going to have hysterics. Oh my God, don't let it get to you. Think about Gribble, and don't let...
But it was happening. The laughter came roaring out of him until his stomach was knotted and cramped, and he was walking bent-legged, and somebody was hollering at him, screaming at him over the roar of the crowd. It was McVries.
"Ray! Ray! What is it? You all right?"
"They're funny!"
He was nearly weeping with laughter now.
"Pete! Pete! They're so funny! It's just, they're so funny!"
A hard-faced little girl in a dirty sundress sat on the ground, pouty-mouthed and frowning. She made a horrible face as they passed. Garrity nearly collapsed with laughter and drew a warning. It was strange. In spite of all the noise, he could still hear the warnings clearly.
"I could die," he thought. "I could just die laughing. Wouldn't that be a scream?"
Collie was still smiling gaily and waving and cursing spectators and newsmen roundly, and that seemed funniest of all. Garrity fell to his knees and was warned again. He continued to laugh in short, barking spurts, which were all his laboring lungs would allow.
"He's gonna puke,"
someone cried in an ecstasy of delight.
"Watch him, Alice. He's gonna puke!"
"Garrity! Garrity, for God's sake!"
McVries was yelling. He got an arm around Garrity's back and hooked a hand into his armpit. Somehow he yanked him to his feet, and Garrity stumbled on.
"Oh, God!"
Garrity gasped.
"Oh, Jesus Christ! They're killing me! I can't!"
He broke into loose, trickling laughter once more. His knees buckled. McVries ripped him to his feet once more. Garrity's collar tore. They were both warned.
"That's my last warning," Garrity thought dimly.
"I'm on my way to see that fabled farm. Sorry, Jan.
"Come on, you turkey! I can't lug you!" McVries hissed.
"I can't do it,"
Garrity gasped.
"My wind's gone. I—"
McVries slapped him twice quickly, forehand on the right cheek, backhand on the left. Then he walked away quickly, not looking back. The laughter had gone out of him now, but his gut was jelly, his lungs empty and seemingly unable to refill. He staggered drunkenly along, weaving, trying to find his wind. Black spots danced in front of his eyes, and a part of him understood how close to fainting he was. His one foot fetched against his other foot. He stumbled, almost fell, and somehow kept his balance.
"If I fall, I die. I'll never get up."
They were watching him. The crowd was watching him. The cheers had died away to a muted, almost sexual murmur. They were waiting for him to fall down. He walked on, now concentrating only on putting one foot out in front of the other. Once, in the 8th grade, he had read a story by a man named Ray Bradbury, and this story was about the crowds that gather at the scenes of fatal accidents, about how these crowds always have the same faces, and about how they seem to know whether the wounded will live or die.
"I'm going to live a little longer," Garrity told them. "I'm going to live. I'm going to live a little longer."
He made his feet rise and fall to the steady cadence in his head. He blotted everything else out, even Jan. He was not aware of the head, or of Collie Parker, or of Freaky D'Alessio. He was not even aware of the steady, dull pain in his feet and the frozen stiffness of the hamstring muscles behind his knees. The thought pounded in his mind like a big kettle drum, like a heartbeat. Live a little longer. Live a little longer. Live a little longer. Until the words themselves became meaningless and signified nothing. It was the sound of the guns that brought him out of it. In the crowd hushed stillness, the sound was shockingly loud, and he could hear someone screaming. Now you know, he thought. You live long enough to hear the sound of the guns, long enough to hear yourself screaming. But one of his feet kicked a small stone then, and there was pain, and it wasn't him that had bought it. It was 64, a pleasant, smiling boy named Frank Morgan. They were dragging Frank Morgan off the road. His glasses were dragging and bouncing on the pavement, still hooked stubbornly over one ear. The left lens had been shattered.
I'm not dead, he said dazedly.
Shock hit him in a warm blue wave, threatening to turn his legs to water again.
Yeah, but you ought to be, McVries said.
You saved him,
Olsen said, turning it into a curse.
Why did you do that? Why did you do that?
His eyes were as shiny and as blank as doorknobs.
I'd kill you if I could. I hate you. You're gonna die, McVries. You wait and see. God's gonna strike you dead for what you did. God's gonna strike you dead as dog shit.
His voice was pallid and empty. Garrity could almost smell the shroud on him. He clapped his own hands over his mouth and moaned through them. The truth was that the smell of the shroud was on all of them. Piss on you, McVries said calmly. I pay my debts, that's all. He looked at Garrity. We're square, man. It's the end, right? He walked away, not hurrying, and was soon only another colored shirt about 20 yards ahead. Garrity's wind came back, but very slowly, and for a long time he was sure he could feel a stitch coming in his side, but at last that faded. McVries had saved his life. He had gone into hysterics, had a laughing jag, and McVries had saved him from going down. We're square, man. It's the end, right? All right.
God will punish him.
Hank Olsen was blaring with dead and unearthly assurance.
God will strike him down.
Shut up or I'll strike you down myself, Abraham said.
The day grew yet hotter, and small, quibbling arguments broke out like brush fires. The huge crowd dwindled a little as they walked out of the radius of TV cameras and microphones, but it did not disappear or even break up into isolated knots of spectators. The crowd had come now, and the crowd was here to stay. The people who made it up merged into one anonymous crowd face, a vapid, eager visage that duplicated itself mile by mile. It peopled doorsteps, lawns, driveways, picnic areas, gas station tarmacs, where enterprising owners had charged admission, and, in the next town they passed through, both sides of the street in the parking lot of the town supermarket. The crowd face mugged and gibbered and cheered, but always remained essentially the same. It watched voraciously as Wyman squatted to make his bowels work. Men, women, and children, the crowd face was always the same, and Garrity tired of it quickly. He wanted to thank McVries, but somehow doubted that McVries wanted to be thanked. He could see him up ahead, walking behind Barkovich. McVries was staring intently at Barkovich's neck. 9:30 came and passed. The crowd seemed to intensify the heat, and Garrity unbuttoned his shirt to just above his belt buckle. He wondered if Freaky D'Alessio had known he was going to buy a ticket before he did. He supposed that knowing wouldn't have really changed things for him, one way or the other. The road inclined steeply, and the crowd fell away momentarily as they climbed up and over four sets of east-west railroad tracks that ran below, glittering hotly in their bed of cinders. At the top, as they crossed the wooden bridge, Garrity could see another belt of woods ahead, and the built-up, almost suburban area through which they had just passed to the right and left. A cool breeze played over his sweaty skin, making him shiver. Scram sneezed sharply three times.
"I am getting a cold," he announced disgustedly.
"That'll take the starch right out of you," Pearson said.
"That's a bitch."
"I'll just have to work harder," Scram said.
"You must be made of steel," Pearson said. "If I had a cold, I think I'd roll right over and die. That's how little energy I've got left."
"Roll over and die now," Barkovich yelled back. "Save some energy."
"Shut up and keep walking, killer," McVries said immediately. Barkovich looked around at him.
"Why don't you get off my back, McVries? Go walk somewhere else."
"It's a free road. I'll walk where I damn well please." Barkovich hawked, spat, and dismissed him. Garrity opened one of his food containers and began to eat cream cheese on crackers. His stomach growled bitterly at the first bite, and he had to fight himself to keep from wolfing everything. He squeezed a tube of roast beef concentrate into his mouth, swallowing steadily. He washed it down with water and then made himself stop there. They walked by a lumber yard where men stood atop stacks of planks, silhouetted against the sky like Indians, waving to them. Then they were in the woods again, and silence seemed to fall with a crash. It was not silent, of course. Walkers talked, the half-track ground along mechanically, somebody broke wind, somebody laughed, somebody behind Garrity made a hopeless little groaning sound. The sides of the road were still lined with spectators, but the great Century Club crowd had disappeared, and it seemed quiet by comparison. Birds sang in the high-crowned trees. The furtive breeze now and then masked the heat for a moment or two, sounding like a lost soul as it soughed through the trees. A brown squirrel froze on a high branch, tail bushed out, black eyes brutally attentive, a nut caught between his rat-like front paws. He chittered at them, then scurried higher up and disappeared. A plane droned far away, like a giant fly. To Garrity, it seemed that everyone was deliberately giving him the silent treatment. McVries was still walking behind Barkovich. Pearson and Baker were talking about chess. Abraham was eating noisily and wiping his hands on his shirt. Scram had torn off a piece of his t-shirt and was using it as a hanky. Collie Parker was swapping girls with Wyman. And Olson, but he didn't even want to look at Olson, who seemed to want to implicate everyone else as an accessory in his own approaching death. So he began to drop back, very carefully, just a little at a time, very mindful of his three warnings, until he was in step with Stebbins. The purple pants were dusty now. There were dark circles of sweat under the armpits of the chambray shirt. Whatever else Stebbins was, he wasn't Superman. He looked up at Garrity for a moment, lean face questioning, and then he dropped his gaze back to the road. The knob of spine at the back of his neck was very prominent. "How come there aren't more people?" Garrity asked hesitantly. "Watching, I mean." For a moment, he didn't think Stebbins was going to answer. But finally he looked up again, brushed the hair off his forehead, and replied, "There will be. Wait a while. They'll be sitting on roofs three deep to look at you." "But somebody said there was billions bet on this. You'd think they'd be lined up three deep the whole way, and that there'd be TV coverage."
"It's discouraged.
Why? Why ask me?
Because you know, Garrity said, exasperated.
How do you know?
Jesus, you remind me of the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland sometimes, Garrity said. Don't you ever just talk?
How long would you last with people screaming at you from both sides? The body odor alone would be enough to drive you insane after a while. It would be like walking 300 miles through Times Square on New Year's Eve.
But they do let them watch, don't they? Someone said it was one big crowd from Old Town on.
I'm not the caterpillar anyway, Stebbins said with a small, somehow secretive smile. I'm more the white rabbit type, don't you think? Except I left my gold watch at home and no one has invited me to tea. At least, to the best of my knowledge, no one has. Maybe that's what I'll ask for when I win. When they ask me what I want for my prize, I'll say, why, I want to be invited home for tea.
God damn it!
Stebbins smiled more widely, but it was still only an exercise in lip pulling. Yeah, from Old Town or thereabouts, the damper is off. By then, no one is thinking very much about mundane things like B.O. And there's continuous TV coverage from Augusta. The long walk is the national pastime, after all.
Then why not here?
Too soon, Stebbins said. Too soon. From around the next curve, the guns roared again, startling a pheasant that rose from the underbrush in an electric uprush of beating feathers. Garrity and Stebbins rounded the curve, but the body bag was already being zipped up. Fast work. He couldn't see who it had been.
You reach a certain point, Stebbins said, when the crowd ceases to matter, either as an incentive or a drawback. It ceases to be there. Like a man on a scaffold, I think. You burrow away from the crowd.
I think I understand that, Garrity said. He felt timid.
If you understood it, you wouldn't have gone into hysterics back there and needed your friend to save your ass. But you will.
How far do you burrow, I wonder?
How deep are you?
I don't know.
Well, that's something you'll get to find out, too. Plumb the unplumbed depths of Garrity. Sounds almost like a travel ad, doesn't it? You burrow until you hit bedrock. Then you burrow into the bedrock. And finally you get to the bottom. And then you buy out. That's my idea. Let's hear yours.
Garrity said nothing. Right at present, he had no ideas.
The walk went on. The heat went on. The sun hung suspended just above the line of trees the road cut its way through. Their shadows were stubby dwarves. Around 10 o'clock, one of the soldiers disappeared through the back hatch of the half-track and reappeared with a long pole. The upper two-thirds of the pole was shrouded in cloth. He closed the hatch and dropped one end of the pole into a slot in the metal. He reached under the cloth and did something, fiddled something, probably a stud. A moment later, a large dun-colored sun umbrella popped up. It shaded most of the half-track's metal surface. He and the other two soldiers currently on duty sat cross-legged in the army drab parasol's shade.
You rotten sons of bitches!
Somebody screamed.
My prize is gonna be your public castration!
The soldiers did not seem exactly struck to the heart with terror at the thought. They continued to scan the walkers with their blank eyes, referring occasionally to their computerized console.
They probably take this out on their wives, Garrity said, when it's over.
Oh, I'm sure they do, Stebbins said, and laughed.
Garrity didn't want to walk with Stebbins anymore. Not right now. Stebbins made him uneasy. He could only take Stebbins in small doses. He walked faster, leaving Stebbins by himself again. 10:02. In 23 minutes he could drop a warning, but for now he was still walking with three.
It didn't scare him the way he had thought it would. There was still the unshakable blind assurance that this organism, Ray Garrity, could not die. The others could die. They were extras in the movie of his life. But not Ray Garrity, star of that long-running hit film, The Ray Garrity Story. Maybe he would eventually come to understand the untruth of that, emotionally as well as intellectually. Maybe that was the final depth of which Stebbins had spoken. It was a shivery, unwelcome thought. Without realizing it, he had walked 3/4 of the way through the pack. He was behind McVries again. There were 3 of them in a fatigue-ridden conga line, Barkovich at the front, still trying to look cocky but flaking a bit around the edges, McVries with his head slumped, hands half-clenched, favoring his left foot a little now, and bringing up the rear, the star of the Ray Garrity Story himself. "And how do I look?" he wondered. He rubbed a hand up the side of his cheek and listened to the sharp rasp his hands made against his light beard stubble. Probably he didn't look all that snappy himself. He stepped up his pace a little more until he was walking abreast of McVries, who looked over briefly and then back at Barkovich. His eyes were dark and hard to read. They climbed a short, steep, and savagely sunny rise, and then crossed another small bridge. 15 minutes went by, then 20. McVries didn't say anything. Garrity cleared his throat twice, but said nothing. He thought that the longer you went without speaking, the harder it gets to break the silence. Probably McVries was pissed that he had saved his ass now. Probably McVries had repented of it. That made Garrity's stomach quiver emptily. It was all hopeless and stupid and pointless, most of all that. So goddamn pointless, it was really pitiful. He opened his mouth to tell McVries that, but before he could, McVries spoke. "Everything's all right." Barkovich jumped at the sound of his voice, and McVries added, "Not you, killer. Nothing's ever going to be all right for you. Just keep striding."
"Eat my meat,"
Barkovich snarled. "I guess I caused you some trouble," Garrity said in a low voice. "I told you fair is fair, square is square, and quits are quits," McVries said evenly. "I won't do it again. I want you to know that."
"I understand that," Garrity said. "I just..."
"Don't hurt me,"
someone screamed.
"Please don't hurt me."
It was a redhead with a plaid shirt tied around his waist. He had stopped in the middle of the road and he was weeping. He was given first warning. And then he raced toward the half-track, his tears cutting runnels through the sweaty dirt on his face, red hair glinting like a fire in the sun.
"Don't! I can't! Please! My mother! I can't! Don't! No more! My feet!"
He was trying to scale the side, and one of the soldiers brought the butt of his carbine down on his hands. The boy cried out and fell in a heap. He screamed again, a high, incredibly thin note that seemed sharp enough to shatter glass, and what he was screaming was,
"My feet!"
"Jesus," Garrity muttered. "Why doesn't he stop that?"
The screams went on and on. "I doubt if he can," McVries said clinically. "The back treads of the half-track ran over his legs." Garrity looked and felt his stomach lurch into his throat. It was true. No wonder the red-headed kid was screaming about his feet. They had been obliterated.
"Warning! Warning, 38!
"I want to go home,"
someone behind Garrity said, very quietly.
"Oh, Christ! Do I ever want to go home?"
A moment later, the red-headed boy's face was blown away. "I'm going to see my girl in Freeport," Garrity said rapidly. "And I'm not going to have any warnings, and I'm going to kiss her. God, I miss her. God, Jesus, did you see his legs? They were still warning him, Pete,
like they thought he was going to get up and walk.
Another boy has gone over to that Silver City, Lord, Lord, Barkovich intoned.
Shut up, killer, McVree said absently.
She pretty, Ray? Your girl?
She's beautiful. I love her.
McVree smiled.
Gonna marry her?
Yeah, Garrity babbled. We're gonna be Mr. and Mrs. Norman Normal, four kids and a collie dog.
His legs! He didn't have any legs. They ran over him. They can't run over a guy. That isn't in the rules. Somebody ought to report that. Somebody.
Two boys and two girls. That what you're gonna have?
Yeah, she's beautiful. I just wish I hadn't.
And the first kid will be Ray Jr., and the dog'll have a dish with its name on it, right?
Garrity raised his head slowly, like a punch-drunk fighter.
Are you making fun of me?
Or what?
No! Barkovich exclaimed. He's shitting on you, boy, and don't you forget it. But I'll dance on his grave for you, don't worry.
He cackled briefly.
Shut up, killer, McVree said.
I'm not dumping on you, Ray. Come on, let's get away from the killer here.
Shove it up your ass,
Barkovich screamed after them.
She love you, your girl, Jan?
Yeah, I think so, Garrity said.
McVree shook his head slowly.
All of that romantic horse shit. You know, it's true. At least for some people, for some short time it is. It was for me. I felt like you.
He looked at Garrity.
You still want to hear about the scar?
They rounded a bend, and a camperload of children squealed and waved.
Yes, Garrity said.
Why?
He looked at Garrity, but his suddenly naked eyes might have been searching himself.
I want to help you, Garrity said.
McVries looked down at his left foot.
Hurts. I can't wiggle the toes very much anymore. My neck is stiff and my kidneys ache.
My girl turned out to be a bitch, Garrity. I got into this long walk shit the same way that guys used to get into the Foreign Legion. In the words of the great rock and roll poet, I gave her my heart, she tore it apart, and who gives a fart?
Garrity said nothing. It was 10:30. Freeport was still far.
Her name was Priscilla, McVree said.
You think you got a case? I was the original corny kid. Moon June was my middle name. I used to kiss her fingers. I even took to reading Keats to her out in back of the house when the wind was right. Her old man kept cows, and the smell of cow shit goes, to put it in the most delicate way, in a peculiar fashion with the works of John Keats. Maybe I should have read her Swinburne when the wind was wrong, McVries laughed.
You're cheating what you felt, Garrity said.
Ah, you're the one faking it, Ray. Not that it matters. All you remember is the great romance, not all the times you went home and jerked your meat after whispering words of love in her shell-pink ear.
You fake your way, I'll fake mine.
McVries seemed not to have heard.
These things, they don't even bear the weight of conversation, he said.
J.D. Salinger, John Knowles, even James Kirkwood and that guy Don Breeds. They've destroyed being an adolescent, Garrity. If you're a 16-year-old boy, you can't discuss the pains of adolescent love with any decency anymore. You just come off sounding like fucking Ron Howard with a hard-on.
McVries laughed a little hysterically.
Garrity had no idea what McVries was talking about. He was secure in his love for Jan. He didn't feel in the least self-conscious about it.
Their feet scuffed on the road. Garrity could feel his right heel wobbling. Pretty soon the nails would let go, and he would shed the shoe heel like dead skin.
Behind them, Scram had a coughing fit. It was the walk that bothered Garrity, not all this weird shit about romantic love.
But that doesn't have anything to do with the story, McVree said, as if reading his mind.
about the scar. It was last summer. We both wanted to get away from home, away from our parents, and away from the smell of all that cow shit, so the great romance could bloom in earnest. So we got jobs working for a pajama factory in New Jersey. How does that grab you, Garrity? A PJ factory in New Jersey. We got separate apartments in Newark. Great town, Newark. On a given day, you can smell all the cow shit in New Jersey in Newark. Our parents kicked a little, but with separate apartments and good summer jobs, they didn't kick too much. My place was with two other guys, and there were three girls in with Pris. We left on June the 3rd in my car, and we stopped once around 3 in the afternoon at a motel and got rid of the virginity problem. I felt like a real crook. She didn't really want to screw, but she wanted to please me. That was the Shady Nook Motel. When we were done, I flushed that Trojan down the Shady Nook John and washed out my mouth with a Shady Nook paper cup. It was all very romantic, very ethereal. Then it was on to Newark, smelling the cow shit and being so sure it was different cow shit. I dropped her at her apartment and then went on to my own. The next Monday, we started in at the Plymouth Sleepwear Factory. It wasn't much like the movies, Garrity. It stank of raw cloth, and my foreman was a bastard. And during lunch break, we used to throw baling hooks at the rats under the fabric bags. But I didn't mind, because it was love. See? It was love. He spat dryly into the dust, swallowed from his canteen, then yelled for another one. They were climbing a long, curve-banked hill now, and his words came in out-of-breath bursts. Pris was on the first floor, the showcase for all the idiot tourists who didn't have anything better to do than go on a guided tour of the place that made their jam-jams. It was nice down where Pris was. Pretty pastel walls, nice modern machinery, air conditioning. Pris sewed on buttons from 7 till 3. Just think, there are men all over the country wearing PJs held up by Priscilla's buttons. There's a thought to warm the coldest heart. I was on the 5th floor. I was a bagger. See, down in the basement they dyed the raw cloth and sent it up to the 5th floor in these warm air tubes. They'd ring a bell when the whole lot was done, and I'd open my bin, and there'd be a whole shitload of loose fiber, all the colors of the rainbow. I'd pitchfork it out, put in 200-pound sacks, and chain hoist the sacks onto a big pile of other sacks for the picker machine. They'd separate it. The weaving machines wove it. Some other guys cut it and sewed it into pajamas. And down there on that pretty pastel 1st floor, Pris put on the buttons, while the dumbass tourists watched her and the other girls through this glass wall. Just like the people are watching us today. Am I getting through to you at all, Garrity? The scar, Garrity reminded. I keep wandering away from that, don't I? McVries wiped his forehead and unbuttoned his shirt as they breasted the hill. Waves of wood stretched away before them to a horizon poked with mountains. They met the sky like interlocking jigsaw pieces. Perhaps 10 miles away, almost lost in the heat haze, a fire tower jutted up through the green. The road cut through it all like a sliding gray serpent. At first, the joy and bliss was Keatsville all the way. I screwed her 3 more times, all at the drive-in with the smell of cow shit coming in through the car window from the next pasture. And I could never get all of the loose fabric out of my hair, no matter how many times I shampooed it. And the worst thing was she was getting away from me, going beyond me. I loved her. I really did. I knew it. And there was no way I could tell her anymore so she'd understand. I couldn't even screw it into her. There was always that smell of cow shit. The thing of it was, Garrity, the factory was on piecework,
That means we got lousy wages, but a percentage for all we did over a certain minimum. I wasn't a very good bagger. I did about 23 bags a day, but the norm was usually right around 30. And this did not endear me to the rest of the boys, because I was fucking them up. Harlan down in the dye house couldn't make piecework because I was tying up his blower with full bins. Ralph on the picker couldn't make piecework because I wasn't shifting enough bags over to him. It wasn't pleasant. They saw to it that it wasn't pleasant. You understand?
Yeah, Garrity said.
He wiped the back of his hand across his neck and then wiped his hand on his pants. It made a dark stain.
Meanwhile, down in Buttoning, Pris was keeping herself busy. Some nights she'd talk for hours about her girlfriends, and it was usually the same tune. How much this one was making, how much that one was making, and most of all, how much she was making. And she was making plenty. So I got to find out how much fun it is to be in competition with the girl you want to marry. At the end of the week, I'd go home with a check for $64.40 and put some corn husker's lotion on my blisters. She was making something like 90 a week and socking it away as fast as she could run to the bank. And when I suggested we go someplace Dutch, you would have thought I'd suggested ritual murder. After a while, I stopped screwing her. I'd like to say I stopped going to bed with her. It's more pleasant, but we never had a bed to go to. I couldn't take her to my apartment. There were usually about 16 guys there drinking beer, and there were always people at her place. That's what she said, anyway. And I couldn't afford another motel room, and I certainly wasn't going to suggest we go Dutch on that. So it was just screwing in the back seat at the drive-in. And I could tell she was getting disgusted. And since I knew it, and since I had started to hate her even though I still loved her, I asked her to marry me. Right then, she started wriggling around, trying to put me off, but I made her come out with it, yes or no. And it was no. Sure it was no. Pete, we can't afford it. What would my mom say? Pete, we have to wait. Pete this and Pete that, and all the time, the real reason was her money. The money she was making sewing on buttons. Well, you were damned unfair to ask her. Sure I was unfair, McVree said savagely. I knew that. I wanted to make her feel like a greedy, self-centered little bitch because she was making me feel like a failure.
His hand crept up to the scar.
Only she didn't have to make me feel like a failure because I was a failure. I didn't have anything in particular going for me, except a cock to stick in her, and she wouldn't even make me feel like a man by refusing that.
The guns roared behind them.
Olson? McVries asked. No, he's still back there.
Oh. The scar, Garrity reminded.
Oh, why don't you let it alone? You saved my life.
Shit on you.
The scar.
I got into a fight, McVree said finally, after a long pause. With Ralph, the guy on the picker. He blacked both my eyes and told me I better take off or he'd break my arms as well. I turned in my time and told Pris that night that I'd quit. She could see what I looked like for herself. She understood. She said that was probably best. I told her I was going home, and I asked her to come. She said she couldn't. I said she was nothing but a slave to her fucking buttons, and that I wished I'd never seen her. There was just so much poison inside me, Garrity. I told her she was a fool and an unfeeling bitch that couldn't see any further than the goddamn bank book she carried around in her purse. Nothing I said was fair, but there was some truth in all of it, I guess. Enough. We were at her apartment. That was the first time I'd ever been there, when all her roommates were out. They were at the movies. I tried to take her to bed,
and she cut my face open with a letter opener. It was a gag letter opener. Some friend of hers sent it to her from England. It had Paddington Bear on it. She cut me, like I was trying to rape her. Like I was germs, and I'd infect her. Am I giving you the drift, Ray?
Yes, I'm getting it, Garrity said. Up ahead, a white station wagon with words WHGH Newsmobile lettered on the side was pulled off the road. As they drew near, a balding man in a shiny suit began shooting them with a big newsreel cine camera. Pearson, Abraham, and Jensen all clutched their crotches with their left hand and thumbed their noses with their right. There was a Rockette-like precision about this little act of defiance that bemused Garrity.
I cried, McVree said. I cried like a baby. I got down on my knees and held her skirt and begged her to forgive me, and all the blood was getting on the floor. It was basically a disgusting scene, Garrity. She gagged and ran off into the bathroom. She threw up. I could hear her throwing up. When she came out, she had a towel for my face. She said she never wanted to see me again. She was crying. She asked me why I'd done that to her, hurt her like that. She said I had no right. There I was, Ray, with my face cut wide open, and she's asking me why I hurt her. Yeah. I left with the towel still on my face. I had 12 stitches. And that's the story of the fabulous scar, and aren't you happy? Have you ever seen her since?
No, McVree said. And I have no real urge to. She seems very small to me now, very far away. Pris, at this point in my life, is no more than a speck on the horizon. She really was mental, Ray. Something, her mother, maybe. Her mother was a lush. Something had fixed her on the subject of money. She was a real miser. Distance lends perspective, they say. Yesterday morning, Pris was still very important to me. Now she's nothing. That story I just told you? I thought that would hurt. It didn't hurt. Besides, I doubt if all that shit really has anything to do with why I'm here. It just made a handy excuse at the time.
What do you mean?
Why are you here, Garrity?
I don't know.
His voice was mechanical, doll-like. Freaky D'Alessio hadn't been able to see the ball coming. His eyes weren't right. His depth perception was screwed. It had hit him in the forehead and branded him with stitches. And later, or earlier, all of his past was mixed up and fluid now, he had hit his best friend in the mouth with the barrel of an air rifle. Maybe he had a scar like McVree's.
Jimmy. He and Jimmy had been playing doctor.
You don't know, McVree said. You're dying, and you don't know why.
It's not important after you're dead.
Yeah, maybe, McVree said. But there's one thing you ought to know, Ray, so it won't be all so pointless.
What's that?
Why, that you've been had. You mean you really didn't know that, Ray? You really didn't?
Chapter 9 At 1 o'clock, Garrity took inventory again. 115 miles traveled. They were 45 miles north of Old Town, 125 miles north of Augusta, the state capital, 150 to Freeport, or more. He was terribly afraid there were more than 25 miles between Augusta and Freeport. Probably 230 to the New Hampshire border. And the word was that this walk was sure to go that far. For a long while, 90 minutes or so, no one at all had been given a ticket. They walked. They half listened to the cheers from the sidelines.
and they stared at mile after monotonous mile of piney woods. Garrity discovered fresh twinges of pain in his left calf to go with the steady, wooden throbbing that lived in both of his legs, and the low-key agony that was his feet. Then, around noon, as the day's heat mounted toward its zenith, the guns began to make themselves heard again. A boy named Tressler, 92, had a sunstroke and was shot as he lay unconscious. Another boy suffered a convulsion and got a ticket as he crawdaddied on the road, making ugly noises around his swallowed tongue. Aronson, 1, cramped up in both feet and was shot on the white line, standing like a statue, his face turned up to the sun in neck-straining concentration. And at 1:05, another boy Garrity did not know had a sunstroke. This is where I came in, Garrity thought, walking around the twitching, mumbling form on the road where the rifles sight in, seeing the jewels of sweat in the exhausted and soon-to-be dead boy's hair. This is where I came in. Can't I leave now? The guns roared, and a covey of high school boys sitting in the scant shade of a scout camper applauded briefly. I wish the Major would come through, Baker said pettishly. I want to see the Major. What? Abraham asked mechanically. He had grown gaunter in the last few hours. His eyes were sunk deeper in their sockets. The blue suggestion of a beard patched his face. So I can piss on him, Baker said. Relax, Garrity said. Just relax. All three of his warnings were gone now. You relax, Baker said. See what it gets you. You've got no right to hate the Major. He didn't force you. Force me? Force me? He's killing me, that's all. It's still not... Shut up, Baker said curtly, and Garrity shut. He rubbed the back of his neck briefly and stared up into the whitish-blue sky. His shadow was a deformed huddle almost beneath his feet. He turned up his third canteen of the day and drained it. Baker said, I'm sorry, I surely didn't mean to shout... My feet. Sure, Garrity said. We're all getting this way, Baker said. I sometimes think that's the worst part. Garrity closed his eyes. He was very sleepy.
You know what I'd like to do?
Pearson said. He was walking between Garrity and Baker. Piss on the Major, Garrity said. Everybody wants to piss on the Major. When he comes through again, we'll gang up on him and drag him down, and all unzip and drown him and...
That isn't what I want to do.
Pearson was walking like a man in the last stages of conscious drunkenness. His head made half rolls on his neck. His eyelids snapped up and down like spastic window blinds.
It's got nothing to do with the Major. I just want to go into the next field and lay down and close my eyes. Just lay there on my back in the wheat.
They don't grow wheat in Maine, Garrity said. It's hay.
In the hay, then, and compose myself a poem while I go to sleep.
Garrity fumbled in his new food belt and found nothing in most of the pouches. Finally, he happened on a wax pack of saltines and began washing them down with water. I feel like a sieve, he said. I drink it and it pops out on my skin 2 minutes later. The guns roared again, and another figure collapsed gracelessly, like a tired jack-in-the-box.
45, Scram said, joining them. I don't think we'll even get to Portland at this rate.
You don't sound so good,
Pearson said, and there might have been careful optimism in his voice.
Lucky for me, I got a good constitution, Scram said cheerfully. I think I'd be running a fever now.
Jesus, how do you keep going? Abraham asked, and there was a kind of religious fear in his voice.
Me? Talk about me? Scram said. Look at him. How does he keep going? That's what I'd like to know.
And he cocked his thumb at Olson. Olson had not spoken for 2 hours. He had not touched his newest canteen. Greedy glances were shot at his food belt, which was also almost untouched. His eyes, darkly obsidian, were fixed straight ahead. His face was speckled by 2 days of beard, and it looked sickly vulpine. Even his hair, frizzed up and back and hanging across his forehead in front, added to the overall impression of ghoulishness. His lips were parched dry and blistering. His tongue hung over his bottom lip like a dead serpent on the lip of a cave. Its healthy pinkness had disappeared. It was dirty gray now. Road dust clung to it. He's there, Garrity thought. Sure he is. Where Stebbins said we'd all go if we stuck with it long enough. How deep inside himself is he? Fathoms? Miles? Light years? How deep and how dark? And the answer came back to him. Too deep to see out. He's hiding down there in the darkness, and it's too deep to see out.
Olson,
he said softly.
Olson.
Olson didn't answer. Nothing moved but his feet.
I wish he'd put his tongue in at least,
Pearson whispered nervously. The walk went on. The woods melted back, and they were passing through another wide place in the road. The sidewalks were lined with cheering spectators. Garrity signs again predominated. Then the woods closed in again. But not even the woods could hold the spectators back now. They were beginning to line the soft shoulders. Pretty girls in shorts and halters. Boys in basketball shorts and muscle shirts. Gay holiday, Garrity thought. He could no longer wish he wasn't here. He was too tired and numb for retrospect. What was done was done. Nothing in the world would change it. Soon enough, he supposed, it would even become too much of an effort to talk to the others. He wished he could hide inside himself like a little boy rolled up inside a rug, with no more worries. Then everything would be much simpler. He had wondered a great deal about what McVries had said, that they had all been swindled, rooked. But that couldn't be right, he insisted stubbornly to himself. One of them had not been swindled. One of them was going to swindle everyone else. Wasn't that right? He licked his lips and drank some water. They passed a small green sign that informed them the main turnpike was 44 miles hence. That's it, he said to no one in particular. 44 miles to Old Town. No one replied, and Garrity was just considering taking a walk back up to McVries when they came to another intersection, and a woman began to scream. The traffic had been roped off, and the crowd pressed eagerly against the barriers and the cops manning them. They waved their hands, their signs, their bottles of suntan lotion. The screaming woman was large and red-faced. She threw herself against one of the waist-high sawhorse barriers, toppling it and yanking a lot of the bright yellow guard rope after it. Then she was fighting and clawing and screaming at the policeman who held her. The cops were grunting with effort.
I know her, Garrity thought. Don't I know her?
The blue kerchief, the belligerent gleaming eyes, even the navy dress with the crooked hem, they were all familiar. The woman's screams had become incoherent. One pinwheeling hand ripped stripes of blood across the face of one of the cops holding her, trying to hold her. Garrity passed within 10 feet of her. As he walked past, he knew where he had seen her before. She was Percy's mom, of course. Percy, who had tried to sneak into the woods and had snuck right into the next world instead.
I want my boy, she hollered. I want my boy.
The crowd cheered her enthusiastically and impartially.
A small boy behind her spat on her leg and then darted away.
"Jan," Garrity thought. "I'm walking to you, Jan."